This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Enormous honor for me to be here to give the fifth Herb York Memorial Lecture. I did fiddle with the title a little bit from what was advertised on the preceding slide and decided to call this Science and Engineering for the Public Good. I did that after thinking further about Herb's career, which really was about science and engineering for the public good in everything that he did. And I'll be talking, as it indicates here, about policies, priorities, partnerships in this space in the Obama administration. I'm going to cover a lot of ground, and I will go pretty fast in order to do that in the allotted time. But as with all my public talks, this slide deck will be posted on the OSTP website. It will be very easy to find. So if anything interests you that goes by too quickly, you will be able to find the talk on the web. I do want to start with a bit of a tribute to Herb York, although Rachel told you just about all of the essentials. I put my own list up here. I may have gotten the ages slightly wrong. I tried to figure it out from various sources, but at an incredibly young age, the founding director of the Livermore Lab, he was the first director of the Department of Defense Research and Engineering at, I figured, 36. He was the founding chancellor of UC San Diego, as was already noted. He was President Carter's ambassador to the CTBT, as already noted. And what was not noted was, and I don't know how that typo got in there, mentor in arms control to many, including me. I met Herb at a Pugwash conference, and Sybil as well. We were friends ever since. I did have the good fortune to work with and learn from a number of other late great figures in the domain of science and engineering for the public good. Harrison Brown from Caltech at the time, one of my first mentors and a good friend of Herb's and a big figure in science, technology, and public policy. George Kistiakowsky was Eisenhower's chief science advisor in Eisenhower's second term. I also met him at a Pugwash conference, and he became a mentor. Roger Revelle, I think known to just about everybody in this room, by reputation at least, another person I had the privilege to know and work with closely and to learn from. Jerry Wiesner was President Kennedy's science advisor, and then after his assassination for a time, President Johnson's. Pief Panofsky, the founding director of the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and my predecessor as chair of the Committee on International Security and Arms Control at the National Academy of Sciences. Paul Doty founded the Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard, where I spent about 13 years of my adult life. Chuck Vest, president of MIT, member with me of President Clinton's Committee of Advisors on Science and Technology, and later the president of the National Academy of Engineering. Jack Gibbons was President Clinton's chief science advisor and a friend of mine dating back to 1973. There are a number of other giants in the field who fortunately are still alive, people I've learned a lot from. I will mention one in particular from this list who's sitting in the audience, Lou Branscombe, who was my predecessor as the director of the Program on Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. And again, I think a lot of folks in the room know about Lou's amazing career in science and engineering for the public good. All men in those slides. I didn't want to give you the impression that the only people I know working in science and engineering for the public good have been men. I've had the privilege of working with a lot of terrific women in the field. There'll be a test at the end of this talk on how many of these folks you can identify. I will note, since in an interview earlier today I was told there are no women in engineering, or practically none, that Sally Jewell, the Secretary of Interior, and Gina McCarthy, the Administrator of the Environmental Protection Administration, are both engineers. So let me talk about science, engineering, and the public good, for the public good, in the Obama administration, starting with this quote from the president's initial inaugural address in 2009, where he said, "We will restore science to its rightful place in my administration." And I'll say very briefly a few things that he's done to keep that pledge. Presidential appointments. No president has appointed this kind of array of the top leadership of science, engineering, and medicine from the United States to presidential appointments. And at the same time, appointing for the first time a chief technology officer, a chief information officer, a chief data scientist for the U.S. government. We never had any of those things in any previous administration. The president has talked more about science, technology, engineering, and mathematics than any prior president. He's talked about it in both of his inaugural addresses, in every State of the Union address. He's talked twice to annual meetings of the National Academy of Sciences. No other president ever did that. And he's given innumerable major speeches on space policy, advanced manufacturing, energy, and much more. And he's used the White House to celebrate science and engineering for the public good in an extraordinary way. There was never a White House science fair before. There have been five in which we have celebrated winners of science, engineering, technology, mathematics, robotics competitions from around the country. Two White House astronomy nights for kids on the South Lawn with telescopes, astronomers, astronauts, moon rocks. And hundreds of kids whose lives will never be the same for the experience of joining the president and the first lady and the first daughters looking through telescopes and wondering about what's out there. Annual ceremonies for the winners of the National Medals of Science, the National Medals of Technology and Innovation, the U.S. Nobelists, the Kavli Prize winners, and meet and greets in the Oval Office. He actually does more meet and greets for scientists, engineers, science teachers than he does for sports teams, which is, again, is very unusual for American presidents. They always like to meet with the sports teams. This president was the first one to say, if I'm going to meet the Super Bowl champions, I'm also going to meet the young science champions in the Oval Office, and he has done it. He has rebuilt the White House science and technology leadership. He restored the dual hat of the OSTP director as assistant to the president for science and technology. My predecessor did not have that because his president was just less interested in science and technology advice. In the previous administration, only two of the four traditional divisions, which are science, technology, environment, and national security, were actually filled. They left two Senate-confirmed appointments that are authorized unfilled. Those Senate-confirmed appointments were restored by this president immediately so that OSTP had its full Senate-confirmed strength. We've tripled the OSTP staff from what existed in the previous administration. I now have 135 people. That's twice as many as OSTP has ever had. The previous record was 66 in the second Clinton term. President Bush had about 45. The reason we have 135 is this president asks us to do more in science, technology, and innovation than any president ever asked his OSTP to do. We have revitalized the National Science and Technology Council and the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. I'll say more about that in a minute. We have done our best to protect the science and technology budgets under very tight constraints. And this president has launched an unprecedented number of imaginative initiatives in science, engineering, and public policy. And I will give you a list of some of those that you may find boring because there were so many. But I want to tell you about a few of them. But first, talking about science in its rightful place, the place of science in the White House is centered in OSTP. We work very closely with the other entities in the executive office of the president, which are indicated here. We have basically two sets of responsibilities, and this is the division that the great scholar, the late great scholar of science and technology policy, Harvey Brooks, proposed: policy for science and technology, and science and technology for policy. In the first category, Peter Cowie has already mentioned the role of OSTP in formulating the budgets, which we do jointly with OMB, the budgets for science and technology across all the agencies with those responsibilities. But policy for science and technology also includes policy for STEM education and workforce issues, policy for interagency initiatives in science and technology, broadband, open government, scientific integrity, and more. And, of course, the other category, science and technology for policy, is simply making sure that the president and his other senior advisors have the insights from science and technology that they need to address the policy issues that are on their plates. OSTP has a number of other responsibilities, many of which I didn't know about until after I took the job. One of them is providing White House oversight for the NSF and for NASA, which are big science and technology operations that do not have a cabinet secretary above them. So they report to the White House through me. I didn't know that when I took the job. I first learned about it when my secretary said, the administrator of NASA and all his deputy administrators are waiting in your conference room. They have a question about whether the next shuttle launch should go forward. And it will be up to you to decide whether their repairs for the hydrogen problem they're having were adequate. I didn't realize when I took the job that there were actually people's lives that I would have something to say about. I was grateful at that point for my two MIT degrees in aeronautics and astronautics. Chairing and managing the National Science and Technology Council, which I'll say more about, the Arctic Executive Steering Committee, I'll say more about. And we co-chair and help to manage PCAST, the National Ocean Council, the Council on Climate Resilience. We have some major responsibilities related to national security and emergency preparedness communications. In the jargon, they say, this is about making sure the president can communicate with everybody he needs to communicate with on a really bad day. And we have the responsibility for coordinating and overseeing U.S. cooperation in science and technology with other countries, which we do jointly with the State Department, of course. Just a word about the National Science and Technology Council. I chair it. It includes the deputy secretaries and undersecretaries of all the cabinet departments that have science and technology missions and the heads of all the alphabet soup of agencies listed there. It has five standing committees, four of which correspond to OSTP's divisions, science, technology, environment, and national and homeland security. And the fifth one, STEM education, created actually at the demand of the America Competes Act reauthorization of 2010, which said NSTC needs a whole standing committee on STEM education. It's responsible for coordinating all the science and technology activities across departmental lines, and those include some big ones. The U.S. Global Change Research Program, $2.8 billion a year. The National Nanotechnology Initiative, a few billion there as well. The Networking and Information Technology R&D Program. These are all major interagency efforts that are under the oversight of the National Science and Technology Council. Under President Obama, that council has produced over 75 reports for the president and for Congress, by far the most active that the NSTC has ever been. PCAST. PCAST is the current incarnation of PSAC, and a PCAST or its equivalent has existed under every U.S. president since, except for a period under Richard Nixon when he fired his science advisor and all of PSAC for offering advice that he did not like, but even more for allowing the content of that advice to leak into the public domain. Another way you could get on President Nixon's enemies list. There are currently 19 members on PSAC. The Assistant to the President for Science and Technology serves as one of the co-chairs. There are 18 part-time uncompensated special government employees who are the other members, all appointed by the president. And one of them serves as co-chair. The co-chair of this PCAST is Dr. Eric Lander, who's the director of the MIT Harvard Broad Institute for Genomics. The function of PCAST is both to augment the science and technology advice that the president can get from insiders in full-time positions across the government, OSTP, and in the various departments and agencies, but also to help link OSTP and the president to the wider outside science and technology community. And PCAST is supported by an executive secretariat in my office. And this PCAST has produced 30 reports for President Obama, 30 reports at his request. And again, that's far more than any previous PCAST ever produced. This is the rogues gallery of the second term Obama PCAST. And again, there'll be a test afterwards on identifying the affiliations of these folks. The interesting thing, really, is not how many reports PCAST has produced, but how many of its recommendations the president has embraced. You will find, if you look on the OSTP website under PCAST and you look at those reports, you will find that a large number of the initiatives launched by this president had their origin in reports that PCAST provided to him. You may notice just over the president's right shoulder, Mario Molina, who is known in these parts and is one of the members of PCAST. So let me talk about the place of science and technology on the national agenda very quickly. We know that science and technology are not just necessary, they are absolutely central to meeting most of the major challenges that we face. And you can read faster than I can talk, so I will just show them there for a moment. So the president's strategy for dealing with all of that has been, first of all, start with the foundations, strengthen science, technology, engineering, and math education and worker training, from preschool to grad school to lifelong education and training. And particularly, and this has been a huge priority for this president and the First Lady, inspiring, supporting, and mentoring more minorities, girls, and young women, groups historically underrepresented in STEM fields, for success in STEM. Second major ingredient, invest in basic research and the institutions that do it. The president often says basic research is the seed corn on which all future applied advances are going to depend. When he first talked to the annual meeting of the National Academy of Sciences just a few months after being elected, I think everyone expected he'd spend his whole time talking about energy, climate change, biomedicine and public health, national security, all the applications that were on that previous slide. He actually spent about 60% of that talk to the National Academy talking about the importance of basic research. Invest in the infrastructure that supports science, technology, and innovation. Broadband, wireless, high-capacity computing, space platforms, telescopes, accelerators. This may not be the most glamorous thing that the government can invest in for science and technology, but it is certainly one of the most important. Without investments in that domain, we would soon have nothing to work with in science and engineering. This is just a picture of one of his many meetings in the White House with young superstars. These are the middle school mathletes. Continuing with his strategy, create an innovation-friendly policy environment. All kinds of federal policies affect how much innovation actually gets done in society. Tax incentives, the research and experimentation tax credit, we finally succeeded after trying since 2009 in getting that made permanent in the bipartisan budget agreement in December of last year. Access to capital, open markets, a sensible system of intellectual property rights appropriately enforced, even immigration policy, how easy or hard you make it for people skilled in science and engineering and math, how easy or hard you make it for entrepreneurs to get into this country and stay here. Another very important part of the president's strategy is to prioritize within goals, not among them. And that means you don't, for example, say, well, economy is more important than the environment, so we'll mostly do that. Nor do you say environment is more important than the economy, and we'll mostly do that. All of those issues that I listed a couple of slides ago, to which science and technology are central, are important. The president's position is we have to do them all. And so what he has asked the people who work for him to do is focus on the highest leverage opportunities within each of those areas and look for win-wins that serve multiple goals, energy, environment, and national security together, for example. And finally, big principle for this president, exploit the potential of partnerships, partnerships across the branches and levels of government, partnerships within the range of government agencies, partnerships across the public, private, academic, and civil society sectors, and partnerships across nations. This is a statement he has made in many different forms and many different forums. The challenges we face are too big for government to solve alone. We need all hands on deck. So let me talk about some of these initiatives I mentioned earlier, his initiatives in science and engineering for the public good, starting with science and engineering for economic prosperity. And again, I'm going to run through these quickly and let you read them rather than my reading them to you. But the Recovery Act was the first one, really major contribution to science and engineering for the public good. The American Innovation Strategy, which the President first launched in September of 2009, renewed in 2011, and again a revision in 2015, which consisted of investing in the foundations of strength. I already talked about those: basic research, STEM education, S&T infrastructure, promote market-based innovation, catalyze breakthroughs for national priorities, clean energy, advanced manufacturing, biotech, and very importantly, increase support for early career scientists and engineers, increase support for multidisciplinary and high-risk research, increase support for commercializing university research, and increase support for attracting more women, girls, and underrepresented minorities to STEM careers. Data.gov, opening up government data to innovation and entrepreneurship. 175,000-plus government data sets are now available for those purposes. Small Business Lending Act, the NSF Innovation Corps, started in 2011, training doctoral students in how to carry their discoveries into the marketplace. That was replicated by the NIH in 2015 in light of the success of NSF with that program. The American Competes Reauthorization Act, I already mentioned, it has boosted government's innovation capacity in many ways, including giving innovation prize authority to all agencies, giving them the possibility to offer prizes for solving particular problems. There are now in the government 300-plus prize competitions at over 50 agencies, and you can read about all of those at challenge.gov. The Startup America Initiative in 2011 aimed at boosting high-tech entrepreneurship in a number of ways: small business financing, improved regulatory environment, transfer of ideas from labs to market. The Jobs Act of 2012 with crowdfunding, mini public offerings, an IPO on-ramp. The Big Data Initiative in 2012, $200 million, focused on the uses of large data sets for new insights and applications. DOE's Energy Innovation Hubs, partnerships linking national labs, universities, and industry. The Startup America Partnership, $1 billion in private funds to help startups. The Advanced Manufacturing Partnership, which ultimately led to the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation. Again, linking research universities, companies, the federal government, investing in emerging technologies. The National Robotics Initiative, the Materials Genome Initiative, additional partnerships supporting the advanced manufacturing effort. Science and Engineering for Public Health, the Neuroscience Initiative. The larger Neuroscience Initiative is now funded at over $6 billion a year. The Brain Initiative, which has become perhaps the best known part, brain research through advancing innovative neurotechnologies focused on mapping brain function, has over $400 million in the FY16 budget. That's four times as much as the $100 million it started with. Combating antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Enormous problem, enormous challenge for public health. PCAST wrote a report about it. That led to an executive order, a strategic plan, and finally this last year, a national action plan to address the challenge of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The FY16 budget for combating antibiotic-resistant bacteria is $1 billion, up from $600 million the previous year. Continuing with public health, the Precision Medicine Initiative, announced by the President in January of 2015, an approach to medical care that puts together genomics, electronic health records, big data analytics, information about people's environment, about their microbiome, to account better for individuals' characteristics in both prevention and treatment, to better match what we do to the characteristics of the individual. Ingredients in this include cancer genomics, $70 million in the FY16 budget, developing a national cohort of over 1 million volunteers whose genomes, microbiome profiles, and health records are going to be mined to better prevent and treat disease, $130 million in FY16, and redesigning reimbursement to prioritize value over volume. What a novel idea. Science and Engineering for Environment and Energy. The Recovery Act in 2009 had $90 billion for clean and efficient energy, the largest infusion of money ever for that purpose. ARPA-E, the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, was initially funded in the Recovery Act at $200 million a year, has now received over $1.5 billion in resource in it and is making some amazing breakthroughs in the energy space. This administration produced in the first term the first ever fuel economy and CO2 combined tailpipe standards for light-duty vehicles, fuel economy standards for trucks, more standards for appliances for both residences and businesses. The stuff the U.S. Department of Energy has done to understand the innovation space in energy has been simply extraordinary. This president established the first ever National Oceans Policy in 2010 that's implemented through the Interagency National Oceans Council. And again, it's being done in partnership with states, with regions, with the private sector, and with civil society. This is the president signing the National Oceans Policy Executive Order in July of 2010. Standing next to him on his right is Nancy Sutley, the first head of the CEQ, the Council on Environmental Quality, under President Obama. Here's something about San Diego. One of the things we've been promoting is the Sustainable Cities Initiative, and San Diego is a wonderful pioneer in this space. With the San Diego Supercomputing Center, the Clean Tech San Diego operation, OSIsoft, San Diego Gas and Electric, all working together on making this a sustainable city. And we are doing that in Detroit. We are doing it in many other places around the country. But I do think San Diego is out in front on this issue. The Arctic Executive Steering Committee, in January of last year, the president decided that we needed more coordination among the 20-plus departments and agencies that have responsibilities in the Arctic. And so he created by executive order a steering committee that consists of the heads of all of those agencies. It is chaired by me. The vice chair is the deputy homeland security advisor. And it has these four big tasks that are indicated here. And it has been extremely active since its founding a little more than a year ago. A large part of its effort is focused on the effects of climate change in the Arctic and how to cope with those. Science and engineering for national and homeland security. I'll put a few items up here that are not so well known. We have developed a near-Earth objects strategy. Near-Earth objects are big chunks of stuff in space that could run into us with serious consequences. That has happened from time to time over geologic time. We've had some modest collisions in more recent times. We need to prove we're smarter than the dinosaurs. It's generally thought that the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago when a very large asteroid struck the Earth and threw up a huge tidal wave and such a cloud of smoke and dust that basically most organisms died out. The president asked me in 2011 to start, when we had a few modest-sized asteroids pass close enough to the Earth that they were inside of the orbit of the moon. This caught the president's attention, and he asked me to start working on a strategy for dealing with near-Earth objects, a multi-pronged upgrade of national efforts on detection, characterization, and deflection of asteroids that are on potential collision courses with the Earth. This has links to NASA's Asteroid Redirect mission, of which I am a strong defender. Space Weather Initiative, this is another one, where some major solar storms that disrupted radio communications and GPS navigation across much of the Northern Hemisphere got the president's attention. He said to me and his Homeland Security advisor, I want a strategy on dealing with space weather. We need to be better prepared. And OSTP has been leading ever since an interagency program to upgrade our understanding of solar storms and resilience against them. Biodefense strategy. We lead in my office together with the National Security Council staff the components of biodefense strategy that are focused on biosurveillance and on countermeasures. Cybersecurity. No one has heard of that issue lately, I'm sure. We have some huge challenges there. The National Security Council is leading and OSTP is supporting a comprehensive approach to upgrading cybersecurity, largely based on two reports that PCAST wrote at President Obama's request, one classified and one unclassified, and OSTP has the lead on crafting a cybersecurity research and development strategy. the National Strategic Computing Initiative. Just last year, something over $200 million a year in government funds in the OSTP-led public-private partnership to accelerate progress in high-capacity computing. And we're very careful to say high-capacity because computing is not just about speed. There's a lot of hand-wringing about the fact the Chinese have the fastest computer in the world. Their fast computer is not nearly as capable as our supercomputers because we are much better at handling the gigantic data flows in and out of the machine and processing the data when they're in the machine than the Chinese are with their super fast machine, which, by the way, they built mostly with Intel components. A strategic plan for science and technology for national security has been under development for the last couple of years in my office, and it will shortly be released. It includes a strategy for attracting and retaining top talent in the defense, science, and technology space, bolstering infrastructure, and accelerating innovation. Science and Engineering for International Relations. The President instructed me in my first week in office that he wanted me to revive and strengthen the joint commissions on science and technology cooperation that the United States has with China, India, Brazil, Japan, South Korea, and Russia. There are six of those that are at the ministerial level, which I co-chair with the science and technology minister of the respective countries. There are 40 others that are led by the State Department with support from my office, but the top six, I have to go to all of these, and we actually get an extraordinary amount done. Responsible also for nurturing the strong science and technology cooperation that we've long had with our friends in the European Union, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Streamlining the visa procedures. I mentioned this briefly before. If we make it too hard for visitors to get into the country to interact with us on science and engineering, we shoot ourselves in the foot. We've actually done that quite a lot, but we've been working on improving that situation. Science and technology, not many people notice this, but science and technology was made the centerpiece of USAID strategy at the beginning of this administration, and it remains there. The White House and the State Department have collaborated on a science envoy program, which has sent very eminent American scientists around the world to work particularly in developing countries on strengthening science and technology and our links with them. And we have convened the Multilateral Economic Forum, the U.S.-China and U.S.-India Strategic and Economic Dialogue, the U.S.-China Dialogue on Innovation Policy, where Peter Cowie has been a major force, all with strong science and technology focuses. This is the first two cohorts of science envoys and the places where they went. I think you will see some familiar names in there. There have now been five cohorts of science envoys dispatched around the world by this administration. Again, never happened before. This is a picture from one of the U.S.-China innovation dialogues. I'm sitting next to Minister Wang Gan, the science and technology minister of China, who, to our great good fortune, spent 15 years in Germany and rose to be the director of research for Audi before he came back to China. So this is somebody who actually understands innovation in the Western model, and he really has been a great partner in this dialogue on innovation. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about a few of the initiatives in STEM education, as that has been so important as one of the foundations of our science and engineering strategy. Educate to Innovate started in 2009, over $750 million in corporate and philanthropic resources to improve classroom experiences at the K-12 level in STEM education. Change the Equation, more than 100 CEOs and a full-time staff engaged with improving math education K-12. 100K in 10 is a program aimed at training 100,000 excellent new STEM teachers by 2021, and as we must be at this point, we are on track. We're halfway there. STEM Master Teacher Corps started in 2012, which engages outstanding STEM teachers in training and mentoring their colleagues and gives them $20,000 a year extra for their trouble. President, again, loves to meet with outstanding teachers and mentors. Here he is hobnobbing with about 50 of them in the White House. Undergraduate STEM Ed Initiative, aimed at transforming the first 2 years of undergraduate STEM education to increase engagement, hands-on learning, freshmen and sophomores in science labs. NST STEM Ed Strategic Plan, completed in stages over 2013 and 2014 to coordinate and focus the more than 100 federal agency STEM education programs. The STEM Inclusion Initiative, which we started in 2014, aimed through multiple partnerships at engaging and supporting girls and minorities. And ConnectEd 2015, $2 billion from the FCC, $1 billion plus from the private sector to provide broadband access and computers for classrooms all across the country. So very quickly, a little case study. I know everybody expects me to talk about energy and climate change, so I will do that for a minute. I'll talk about how science and engineering shaped the president's climate action plan. Science and engineering underpinnings of that action plan. We know, beyond reasonable doubt, about six things that are relevant. We know that the climate is changing at a pace and in a pattern that cannot be explained by our rather good understanding of what the natural influences are. We know that the dominant cause of what is happening is, in fact, our emissions, carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping substances that come mainly from fossil fuel burning and land use change. We know, beyond reasonable doubt, that those changes are already causing harm to life, health, property, economies, and ecosystems through more heat waves, more extreme downpours, more of the most powerful storms, more wildfires, and much else. We know that that harm will continue to grow for decades, both because of the momentum in the climate system and the inertia in society's energy system. And we know, at the same time, that the projected harm, the harm we can expect, will be much smaller if we take prompt, strong, evasive action than if we postpone, if we don't take strong action. We know that technologies already in the marketplace or within reach, with modest investments in research, development, and demonstration, can drastically reduce the offending emissions at costs small compared to the expected damages from inaction. Those key understandings from science and engineering provided the motivation behind the Climate Action Plan, the motivation to develop a cost-effective plan to reduce the impacts. Those understandings provided the sense of urgency for doing so now rather than waiting. They provided the awareness that such a plan has to include both mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation is not enough because we can't stop climate change in its tracks. We must invest in measures to increase resilience and preparedness for what is coming. And those understandings provided the knowledge of the sources of the offending emissions and the character of society's vulnerabilities to provide appropriate specificity in designing a plan. And they also provided the recognition that any U.S. plan has to include a component to bring other countries along. So the president, in June of 2013, rolled out his climate action plan. He'd actually done much in the first term to lay the foundations for it. I talked about some of those things earlier. The three major components of the plan: cutting carbon pollution in America, mitigation; preparing the United States for the impacts of climate change, adaptation; preparedness, resilience; and leading international efforts. Those three components defined by the science and engineering understandings that I just mentioned. Mitigation, reducing carbon pollution from power plants, new standards, the Clean Power Plan, reducing other greenhouse gases. It's not just about carbon dioxide. Methane is very important. Hydrofluorocarbons are important. Accelerating U.S. leadership on clean energy, doubling down on energy end-use efficiency, building a 21st century energy infrastructure, which would be more efficient and more resilient. Adaptation. The president directed agencies with an executive order to support climate preparedness and resilience in everything they do. Everything they do. We established both internal and external task forces on how to do it, on resilience. The Interagency Council on Climate Change Preparedness and Resilience, which I co-chair with CEQ, OMB, and the National Security Council. The State, Local, and Tribal Leaders Task Force, where we reached out to the wider community for insight. Managing flood, drought, and wildfire risks, all big deals in the face of climate change. And again, specific initiatives to address them. Mobilizing science and data for climate resilience, the Climate Data Initiative. The third U.S. National Climate Assessment, the Climate Resilience Toolkit, these are all in the domain of responsibility of OSTP, data and science, and we spend a lot of effort on it. International bilateral engagement. U.S.-China joint announcement in November of 2014 was crucial. This was the first time that the presidents of the United States and China stood up together and said, we are the two biggest economies, we are the two biggest emitters, we recognize this problem as a global challenge that cannot be fixed unless we lead, and we will lead together. That was transformative in terms of the international discussion. Subsequent engagement with Mexico, Brazil, India, and Indonesia to encourage their intended nationally determined contributions that all came together in the Paris meeting with 195 countries making commitments, comprehensive reporting requirements, and assistance on both mitigation and adaptation to countries in need. None of that would have happened without the U.S.-China leadership in November of 2014. And finally, mobilizing clean energy and preparedness finance has been very important in gaining the participation of other countries. The path forward on this, what do we have to do to get this across the finish line? We have to defend the request for clean energy research, development, and demonstration, and the request for Earth observation in the President's fiscal year 17 budget. Not everyone in the Congress, as you may have heard, is receptive to this agenda. We need to finalize EPA's power plant rules. Not everyone in the court system has been receptive to that agenda. We need to improve the coverage, the usability, and the user base of the Climate Data Initiative and the Resilience Toolkit so that people actually use the information that's available to make themselves better equipped to deal with climate change. We need to strengthen the partnerships that we've launched across federal, state, local governments, private sector, and civil society. And we need to implement yet another initiative, which we launched a little more than a year ago, the Initiative on Climate Education and Literacy, in order to ensure continuing public support for all of the above. And I'm not actually supposed to talk about elections, so pretend you didn't see this. But it would be nice if we elected a president who will continue and build on President Obama's climate change program. Internationally, we need to build the public-private global partnership for boosting resilience, which we announced in September of 2014. Well, that's over now. We got it. Old slide. I forgot to change that one. We got the comprehensive, equitable, and forward-leaning climate agreement in Paris. We need to begin to plan for the challenges of the steep declines in emissions that we will need after 2030. The Paris Agreement only goes to 2030. We're going to need an encore. And it's going to have to be a big encore to do as much as will be required to stabilize the climate. And to that end, we need to substantially ramp up global research, development, and demonstration of improved and new clean energy technologies that such emission cuts are going to require. And that was helped by another announcement in Paris, Mission Innovation. The 20 leading countries in energy R&D have committed to double their government's investments in clean energy R&D over the next 5 years. And the President's FY17 budget, in fact, includes proposals to do that. Few other challenges and opportunities going forward. One is the budget challenge. We have not been able to do what we wanted to do for federal R&D. The constraints imposed by the Congress have been too tight. You're looking here at the history of federal R&D. Investments from 1995 to 2016, and aside from the huge boost we got in the Recovery Act in 2009, it's been not much better than flat in real terms. This is corrected for inflation. You can see NIH has the biggest part of it. We have done as well as we have, keeping it more or less flat, only because of the President's commitment to fight for sensible budgets in science and technology. Sustaining federal science and engineering budgets going forward is going to remain difficult, especially for items that are either big-ticket items or that are controversial. I've listed some of them here. NASA, the James Webb Space Telescope, very expensive. Advanced space technology, so we could actually send humans to Mars someday. We can't do it with today's technology. Also expensive. NOAA, polar orbiting satellites, crucial to weather forecasting, to hurricane tracking. The constellation of those satellites is in fragile shape. We need to spend more money to bolster it. NOAA tried a few years ago to start a climate service to match the weather service, but focused on climate per se. Congress didn't like it. We're still having trouble with that. DOE, some very expensive items, capturing and sequestering carbon dioxide away from the atmosphere, nuclear fusion, very costly programs. But we should, if we are sensible, continue to invest in them in the hope that they will materialize in practical and affordable form. They could be part of the encore that we will need after 2030. NSF, inexplicably, having trouble with some members of Congress who don't think basic research is something the federal government should be investing in, and they particularly seem to hate research in social science. Again, blind to the enormous advances in our understanding, the effectiveness of our institutions that have come from research in social science. USDA, we've been working hard to increase peer-reviewed agricultural science. EPA and FDA, we need more what is called regulatory science, science in support of sensible regulation, but anything called regulatory science is not liked by many members of Congress. U.S. Global Change Research Program, climate science, sustainability science, a lot of folks in Congress don't like those either. We have managed to maintain the USGCRP at $2.7, $2.8 billion a year. It really needs more. International cooperation in science and technology, amazingly hard to get through the Congress. Most agencies hide it in other budget lines because if the word international is on it, it's a bullseye for congressional budget cutters. They believe that cooperation in science and technology is a hose through which U.S. competitive advantage is siphoned into the possession of our competitors. This is not, in fact, the case. NIH funding, less contentious, but still hard to increase in percentage terms because it's already so big. FY17 budget has about $33 billion for the NIH. And still, the success rate in proposals to NIH is about 17%. One proposal in six of proposals that are already self-selected because it's so demanding to apply for an NIH grant, one in six get funded. R&D, most recently, you can see the president in FY17 is determined to continue to boost it, but these are current dollars. Inflation between 16 and 17 is expected to be about 1.8%, so you can subtract that if you want to see the real growth. It's not enough, but it's as much as we could get in under the budget caps that still prevail. Very quickly, some other challenges looking ahead, accelerating the translation of advances in science and engineering into benefits, addressing systemic weaknesses in STEM education, which are considerable, avoiding a new nuclear arms race with Russia. We are in some danger of that. And if Herb York were alive today, he would be manning the trumpets about this danger. Falling into that trap would be even more foolish today than it was the first time around, as Herb York chronicled in his famous book, Race to Oblivion. And getting key messages across why science and engineering matter to economy, to health, to environment, to security, and how science works, and what are the sources of credibility in science. There are big opportunities, too, harnessing the full potential of partnerships, building on the momentum of the Paris conference, exploiting recent advantages in biomedical science and big data, applying current infotech and digital tech to improve the effectiveness and accessibility of government. I didn't talk about that, but it's another priority. And that's it. Thank you very much.
I'm sure I'm not the only one that's impressed by the depth and range of the initiatives that you've presented to us. But we're all painfully aware that there's going to be a change of administration early next year. So my question, the second sentence is, to what extent are these initiatives going to be sticky through the next administration?
You know, that's a great question, and one has to assume that that will have something to do with who is elected. That is a topic on which I have been advised by counsel not to hold forth. I am here in my official capacity. But I would say that we are working hard to embed as many of these initiatives as possible in ways that will help them survive a transition to a new administration. And there are a couple of reasons for optimism. The initiatives that are aimed, for example, at improving health care have very strong bipartisan support. combating antibiotic resistance, the Brain Initiative, the Precision Medicine Initiative, very strong bipartisan support because members of Congress and their families and friends are also prone to all the same ailments that the rest of us are prone to, and they would like to see them better and more effectively dealt with. So on those issues, I'm not concerned about a lack of support. Probably the most delicate one is climate change, where it would be a shame to lose any more time with a hiatus in federal support for moving forward with climate change mitigation and adaptation. I'm hoping that anybody who is smart enough to be elected president will be smart enough to come around in office to the realization that this is very important. But again, at the moment, listening to the rhetoric, there's some cause for concern from at least some of the candidates.
Just interested to hear what advice you would give to Obama to ensure ongoing successful cooperation between the 20 countries involved in mission innovation.
Well, I wouldn't want to cast this in terms of what advice I would or have given to President Obama, because, again, I'm not allowed to talk publicly about specifically what I say to him. Our conversations in my role as his science advisor are privileged. But if you read what President Obama himself has said about this, you will see that he is determined, first of all, to lead. His FY17 budget proposal increases U.S. clean energy R&D by 20% over the F-16 level. That's a trajectory toward a doubling in 5 years, in fact, better than a doubling in 5 years. He intends to continue to lead, and I will tell you that the president was personally very closely engaged with the leaders of the other countries, the 19 other countries that joined us in making this pledge, and I think it would be a reasonable assumption that he will continue to stay engaged through the rest of his term. I would also expect, because of the clear importance and benefit of improving the array of clean energy technologies available to everyone, that this initiative will continue to have quite a lot of public support in all of the countries concerned.
You were talking about how China and the United States have mentioned that they are the biggest polluters. So my big question would be, what types of policies going forward in the future should the United States commit itself to in terms of helping the kind of climate losers, like places like the Maldives and other very poor countries that will be affected by our policies of pollution and adding to the warming climate?
Well, first of all, it was agreed again in Paris that the developed countries would be providing no less than $100 billion a year in assistance to countries in need for both mitigation and adaptation by 2020. What was reconfirmed in the Paris agreement was that that $100 billion a year would continue at least until 2025, and that if additional countries become prosperous enough to contribute, countries that were perhaps previously lumped with the developing countries but have now become more prosperous, their contributions have to be added to the $100 billion. They cannot be used to reduce the commitment of the original group of countries that committed that. The United States just announced another $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund. I expect we will continue to meet our obligations there. It is a huge problem. I went about a year ago to the UN Conference of Small Island Developing States. The low-lying small island developing states are basically facing an existential threat in the pace of sea level rise. I can tell you that there are no climate change deniers in those countries. None.
There's been a flat line in reading improvement over the last, 10, 20 years, and when asked, U.S. students who were asked if A over 5 or A over 8 was bigger, the answers were about a chance. So how are we going to improve learning for our students?
That's a big question. And a lot of the initiatives I talked about are aimed in various ways at improving learning, but you note that reading improvement is important and is not explicitly part of our STEM ed initiatives, and STEM ed is certainly not the whole ballgame. I'm certainly prepared to believe that reading needs improvement, in part because I see so much evidence that writing needs improvement, and I think reading and writing are rather closely correlated. I think kids who read a lot and read well end up learning to write more clearly and effectively than students who never learned or never became interested in reading. I'd love to see us do more in that domain. I think I'm done. I really appreciate this very engaged audience. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.